Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, September 29th. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online is Patrick Cassidy. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll hear from Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Andy Tomolonis of South Coast Today, Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We'll talk to Ann Wood from the Provincetown Banner. We'll hear from Teo Wolf of the Sandwich Enterprise and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Now, a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the Islands. A proposal for building a new Cape Cod Regional Technical High School has been getting a lot of attention. If you want to know why, the best place to start is probably looking at the price tag, $128 million, with the cost to be shared by 12 towns. To move forward, it has to be approved by a majority of the towns in an upcoming election. Patrick, let's start off with what the Dennis Finance Committee had to say about this.
Yeah, the Dennis Finance Committee, which had actually hosted a forum for all the finance committees of these 12-member towns to discuss this issue, had weighed in, I think, last week and said that they were against it. They basically unanimously voted to urge voters to not support this project. And again, the price tag, as you mentioned, has a lot to do with the folks who are coming out against it.
They voted unanimously against this. The
Dennis Finance Committee was very clear, not so much with some other boards that have weighed in. But again, the price tag, $128 million, it's certainly a lot of money. It's actually down, as we were talking off air before we came on, that it was down from about $140 million originally. Important to point out that the state will kick in some through the school board building administration agency there, and essentially the towns will be on the hook for, I think, $86 million in total of the project. So the state does provide some money here to offset that. But, you know, voters, taxpayers are going to be paying for this. It's a new tech school that would be in Harwich, where the current tech school is. And again, you're starting to see these different boards, whether it's the Board of Selectmen in Mashpee, which again has now weighed in. They were more split than the Dennis Finance Committee, and they came in at a 3-2 vote in favor of the project. That's really kind of interesting because Mashpee in particular and the Board of Selectmen in particular had been talking about this earlier, and they had gotten to the point where they were even talking about leaving the district. Mm-hmm. And some people were even saying, well, why is Mashpee in that district anyway? Why aren't they sending students to Upper Cape Tech versus Cape Tech? And so there was some discussion about leaving the district altogether, and is this worth our money in the larger sense? But they did come down, and essentially the selectmen who voted in favor of supporting this, and again, the selectmen's vote is just that. It's their vote. It doesn't really matter. What matters, as you said, is the vote of voters from all 12 towns. And again, a majority of those voters need to approve the project in order for it to go forward. So that vote is going to be taking place October 24th. That's the big one. We've had a vote in Barnstable where they were talking about how they were going to pay for it, whether they were going to cut services or whether they were going to put it on an override. They went with the override to avoid any cuts in services if the project is approved. But again, all these votes leading up to the October 24th vote are either just opinion in terms of what these boards think voters should do, or they're, in Barnstable's case, how they should pay for it. The vote that matters is October 24th.
Well, there's been some question about why, what the scope of the project, why it's so big, why you're not renovating the existing structure already.
Absolutely. And the building committee, as is always formed in these cases when you're looking at potentially a new school, says they went through the process of analyzing whether a renovation would make sense. It's clearly an older school. I mean, as many of the schools that are being either replaced.
It's about 40
years old, exactly. And you know, 40, 50 years old is essentially the life of these buildings, at least as they were built back then. I think they're still saying that you build a building now, it's 50 years or so before you have to start looking at a new building. And it's clearly a building where, you know, there's some issues. That being said, other people have said, well, why not renovate it? The building committee said they looked at that, and the cost of that would not make sense to do the renovation. You know, again, there's a question as to whenever you get into these building committees, you know, whether the inevitability is a new building or not. Although there have been instances where a building committee has met and they've come out and said, we're going to renovate an older building. They did not find that in this case. And so they recommended, and the superintendent and the school district school committee decided to move forward with this project. And now it's up to the towns. The towns and the voters essentially could decide, no, we're not going to do it. They're all going to vote on the same day, and we'll find out on October 24th how they feel about it.
I thought it was interesting to note the number of students. So Dennis's share of the total, excuse me, would be about $18 million over 30 years. And Dennis is sending 67 students would be sending 67 students to the school this year, say. And so that's not a lot of kids for a pretty big price tag, I would think.
Said Dennis aside, I mean, the town of Truro, I think, is sending one student. Yeah. I mean, but it's important to point out that $18 million or whatever Truro is paying is based on the students. So it's essentially a fair, chunk of the amount of money. So the amount of money is what it is. And then each town will spend the amount of money that equates to the amount of students they have. That will fluctuate over time, and that's something that Dennis Finance Committee raised, that, well, who knows what we're going to pay in the future, because we don't know how many students we're sending there. But each town has to pay for its own students wherever they go. I mean, mm-hmm. whether it's into their own district or if they send them out of district or into a district like this. So you can't escape paying for the students. And that's actually one of the Mashpee Board of Selectmen said, you know, we have to pay for these students somehow. We can't let the students suffer. And that's why I'm voting for this. It is important to point out, I know we've mentioned the Dennis Finance Committee, the Brewster Finance Committee, another town that's part of the district, actually voted in favor of this project and voted to ask that voters favorably vote for this project. So there's clearly a difference of opinion, and there's clearly people concerned about the money. There is a strong contingent out there who say that it's a good school and that it deserves support. I don't think anybody kind of disputes that now, but they say that a new building deserves support. So there's people weighing in on both sides. Again, all that's going to matter is when people go to the ballot box on October 24th.
And one of the selectmen pointing out that it's really an investment in the future of the region to have a very strong tech high school here.
Absolutely. Tech schools clearly have a high success rate in terms of employment and things of that nature.
Here on the Roundup, we've been following the efforts of many towns across the region to stop the utility company Eversource from spraying herbicide under power lines. The company has defended the practice as safe and necessary, but a number of towns disagree. Now one town has won what seems like surprising victory in this kind of long and ongoing battle.
Yeah, and potentially short-lived, but actually one that might get them through this year in terms of not having spraying take place. This was the town of Brewster. They went to Superior Court and got this injunction a week ago today from a judge who essentially said, there's other things going on here, and there's no need to move forward at this point with the spraying. The company says they need to move now. Brewster got out of the spraying last year, and that if they don't move forward by the time the leaves fall, then they can't do it this year. And so that's what it comes down to. Interestingly enough, the other towns that didn't take part in this particular move for this injunction could have potentially received the same treatment, but they decided to opt out of this one. I mean, they had, I think, lost in a number of cases, including before a state agency that basically took no action recently on their request to halt the spraying. And so they probably decided, well, we're not going to win this one. And again, quite honestly, this is an injunction. It doesn't kind of solve the overall question of whether the spraying will be allowed to proceed by a judge. That's going to be something that takes place later. I think there's a hearing that's going to take place at the state level on October 13th. So we're still waiting out a number of these different administrative and legal processes.
We are going to speak now with Sarah Brown of the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Sarah, you have a story about a bomb removal project on the South Shore. This is about material left over from World War II, is that right?
It is, yeah. During World War II, there were several spots on the South Shore of the Vineyard, and also, you know, around New England and elsewhere, that were used as practice dive bombing and strafing ranges. So there's targets set up that were used to help military pilots practice gunnery and bombing skills. And, of course, that left munitions behind and pieces of munitions. And they're scattered along the beach or in areas that were used for practice. And I think they said there could potentially be small arms rounds and practice bombs between 1 and 500 pounds that were left behind, according to the Army. And there's a chance that some of them could still be live or have a charge or, and injure people. And though some aren't dangerous, but it's also really hard to know just from looking at them, and certainly people can't know by when you find one on the beach. So the Army Corps of Engineers has been taking on projects to clean those up, and one of them began in earnest this week out on Tisbury Great Pond in West Tisbury, on the South Shore here, on some privately owned land and also at the Long Point Wildlife Refuge, which is owned by the Trustees of Reservations. And it's a pretty big project. The price tag is a little over $8 million. And they're basically, and they have a crew of like 25 to 30 people and a lot of equipment out there. And they're surveying, basically they've done surveying work to identify, you know, potential munitions that are buried in kind of the upland area. Those are marked in the sand. And they also have an idea of where things might be in the pond. So they will, you know, either excavate to investigate those in the land, or they'll dive down into the pond. And then they'll either discard those or detonate them, depending on what they are. Mm. And divers will also go out into the ocean close to shore, look for munitions in the bottom there. They'll immediately take them because you can't really mark where they are in the ocean. It's so dynamic. But the really dramatic thing that they're doing out at Long Point is looking for munitions in the dunes, in about 700 feet of dune on this barrier beach. And to do that, they are actually kind of leveling the dune a piece at a time. There's a whole process. I think they work 200 feet at a time. And they take off the beach grass, they put it aside, and then they take about a foot and a half of sand away. They survey for bombs, and if they find anything, they take it out. They go down another foot and a half, can survey again, and so on. And then they'll rebuild the dune, and they, you know, kind of move on, kind of do the sleepfrog thing and move on to the next section.
About how long do they think this whole project is going to take?
Well, right now, the start was delayed a little bit because of the bad weather, so they're kind of holding off a little bit. We didn't know what was going to happen with the hurricanes around here. The plan is that they want to finish this by December, because before the bad weather comes in, and certainly I think they want to have the dunes in a decent shape, you know, when that bad weather comes in. If they do have to resume it, they said they would in the spring. And, you know, being aware of shorebird nesting and things like that. But they hope to be done by December. And then they said that they would be doing some kind of maintenance and also replanting the beach grass in the spring as well. So it's one of those things. I think it's always hard to know exactly how long things will take. And there's a similar project that they did up at Little Neck, and that is still going on. They said it's been hard to clear it because they keep finding additional munitions, and then you have to clear 100 feet around it. So it kind of keeps going on and on. So it is hard to know for sure, but they do say that the dune work will be done by December.
Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Bye.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we're going to hear from Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. And joining us now on the phone is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, there was a move in Chatham to ban the sale of helium balloons at Chatham band concerts. And this is controversial.
It is indeed. Have you ever been to a Chatham band concert, Steve?
I have not yet.
They are. It's a fun evening. There are thousands of people crowded in Cape Gould Park, and there's always hundreds of balloons sort of bobbing above the crowd. It's one of the iconic images of Chatham, really. And often those balloons get escape. They float away. Kids let them go or whatever. And more in recent years, people have been questioning the practice of selling the balloons at the band concerts as the impact of balloons on the marine environment has become clear. Clearer, I should say, where you know, the balloons are they pop and they fall in the water. They're ingested by birds, sea turtles, and other creatures, and you know, to obviously deleterious effect. And It also creates a lot of environmental litter. People see balloons along the beaches and during beach cleanups quite frequently. Now, the Chatham Masonic Lodge, which sells the balloons at the band concerts, has used biodegradable latex balloons for a number of years now, and they always say they make sure to tie the strings to the wrists of kids to prevent them from being released. They warn about the danger of the releasing balloons. But there's still been a bit of an outcry that's been bubbling under for a number of years. But on Tuesday, selectmen addressed the issue out during a public discussion, and they considered a proposal for a townwide ban on balloons. And they got quite an earful from balloon opponents, as well as people who feel, including members of the Chatham band, that this is a tradition, goes back more than half a century, and it deserves as much protection as, caring for the environment. Both Provincetown and Nantucket in the area have instituted balloon bans on helium balloons. And at this past Tuesday's selectmen's meeting, there seemed to be a strong sentiment to follow suit. But the board decided on actually a split vote that they would allow the sale of balloons to continue at least until through next summer. And several of the members indicated that they're looking for a more inclusive discussion about possibly banning them completely in the future. So that is something that I don't think it's an issue that's going to go away, just as these balloons really don't go away from the environment.
And Tim, briefly, there are questions about safety with tourists visiting the Chatham Fish Pier. What's at issue here?
Well, Chatham Fish Pier has become one of the most popular destinations in town. They clock it sometimes as many as 3,000 people a day in the summer visit the pier. And the problem is it's also a working industrial facility. Doug Feeney, who's a commercial fisherman and head of the town's Aunt Lydia's Cove Committee, told selectmen this week that he was concerned about near misses, accidents waiting to happen at the fish pier, and he wants the town to kind of address this situation. And that's sort of in process now with major renovations being considered for the pier. And basically what they're looking to do is sort of remove the public portion of the pier from the more industrial area, put more of a divide there, which is going to mean relocating some of the functions, charter boat docks, to different areas of the pier. Mm-hmm. That's under consideration now. It's part of a larger $5 million renovation of the facility that's going to be put into place in the next couple of years. They're working on those plans now, and those will be coming before selectmen, hopefully within the next few months.
Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve. Take care.
We're going to go right now to Andy Tomolonis of SouthCoastToday.com. Andy, good morning.
Hi.
Andy, this week, South Coast Today focused a lot of resources and attention on the opioid epidemic, really pulling together a lot of useful information into a special report. Give us a sense of the scope of this.
Well, like everybody else, New Bedford and South Coast communities are feeling the effects of the national opioid crisis, and we wanted to examine it. But when we did that, we wanted to do our special report going further than simply telling readers, about the rising death toll and the problem. So before we started, we went to a bunch of local experts in the fight against opiate addiction, and we asked them for advice. We met in our boardroom with some addiction counselors, emergency room physicians, EMT managers, hospital administrators, and more. And what we heard was this: to go ahead and present the problem in all its ugliness, but then look for possible solutions. So, what can we do to help stem the tide of overdoses? And our section broke the problem up into two different categories. One, confronting the problem of opioid addiction, and then seeking solutions. And we found some interesting things. The statistics are overwhelming, and they become a blur because there's just so many, so many deaths. There were 2,069 fatal overdoses in the state in 2016. 55 of those deaths were in New Bedford. But it's also a suburban problem. There were 15 in Wareham, 11 in Middleborough, 9 in Dartmouth, and these are some of the tonier communities. You just don't think of it. And so a lot of people have reported that, and our stories presented that, the scope of the problem, and it touched on areas where there may be some promising progress.
Andy, there's an opioid abuse forum coming up. Tell us about this.
Okay, so the Standard Times and South Coast Hospitals Group are co-hosting an opioid forum next week. It's Monday, October 2nd, from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the New Bedford Whaling Museum, and that's in downtown New Bedford. And there'll be a list of, you know, terrific speakers and participants, and we hope to carry on the communication that we started with this special report.
The special report is really a great piece of work. I encourage folks to go to the website southcoasttoday.com and dive into it. There's a lot there.
Yes, there's a quick URL you can get there. It's southcoasttoday.com/opioids.
Andy Tomolonis of southcoasttoday.com, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Steve Junker. With me in the studio is Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, the fishing industry has been watching the case of Carlos Rafael of New Bedford. He's also known as the Cod Father. He was found guilty of a number of charges related to grossly misstating his fishing catches and smuggling money out of the country. He was sentenced this week for those crimes.
Yeah, and obviously a big deal in New Bedford, where Andy was just talking from, but also a big deal for the industry overall, and we've been looking at it from the perspective of fishermen on the Cape and environmentalists and people who are concerned about the effect on the fisheries of the Codfather, Carlos Rafael's fraudulent behavior. He has pleaded guilty and was sentenced this week to 46 months, again, covered by the New Bedford Standard Times. And then we took a look and talked to some folks locally for their reaction. And generally, people thought that was an appropriate sentence, this 46-month jail sentence. He's going to have 3 years supervised release, and there's a $200,000 fine and various other things. But it's still not complete, really. There's a question of what to do with the boats that he used in this scheme. And again, this was a fascinating story from the beginning, where the IRS had sent in basically undercover agents to talk to him about buying his business. And I think they said they were Russians. And there was this whole kind of cloak and dagger thing that was going on. And he ended up going down on these fraudulent activities, which had to do with essentially him taking fish that he had met the quota for, that he didn't have any more quota within his control to use to sell those fish, called them another fish, which then he did have space and a quota for that fish, and he was able to sell them off that way. And again, there were other activities such as smuggling this money out to Portugal, and there was, a Bristol County Sheriff's officer who was involved in that. So again, looking at it kind of more globally, what has happened to the fishery and the industry, and particularly this area because of that? Scientists are basing, you know, models in terms of stock assessments on the amount of fish that are reported caught, and if that's different for one species than is true in actuality. And this is no, you know, small fisherman. This guy controlled one of the largest, if not the largest, fishing fleet in the country. So he could have a real deleterious impact on the fishery as a whole. And so those questions as to what happens after this now and after this sentencing phase are still up in the air, including what the federal government does in terms of civil penalties against them, and what they do with what's called the sector that he was a part of, and really was the sector himself as one entity. So what are they going to do with that is still an open question. We've been asking Noah, and I'm sure the New Bedford Standard Times has been asking them as well, as to what you do now. They have previously said to us that, oh, we're going to wait for sentencing, and then we're going to take action after that. You know, there's a question. He pleaded guilty, so, you know, why do you have to wait to see what a federal judge does to take your action? Noah's been pretty tight-lipped about this and continues to be so even as this sentencing process has played itself out. So we're going to wait and see what they have to do, and we'll see the reaction to that from, again, fishermen, environmentalists. A lot of the fishermen we talked to said 99.9% of us out there are doing the right thing. We're playing by the rules, and then you have this guy come in and muck it all up for us. So it's been a big deal in that industry.
And it has the potential to continue to impact, of course, New Bedford in a big way going forward.
Absolutely.
Josh Balling joins us from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Hello, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, more than any other part of the region, Nantucket felt the effects of Storm Jose last week. What are you looking at now?
There wasn't too much fallout when all was said and done. It was a three-day storm, probably about 2 days longer than most people expected, and it did cancel both boat and plane transportation to and from the island for most of those 3 days. All in all, though, it kept people stranded on both sides, but the supermarkets never ran out of food, the gas stations never ran out of gas, we didn't have any power outages, but it just threw a monkey wrench into a lot of people's plans. These weekends around late September into the middle of October are among the biggest wedding weekends on Nantucket. Hundreds, if not thousands, of people come to the island for weddings and other family celebrations, and as it turned out, because it was a midweek storm and transportation was running again by Saturday morning, some plans had to be changed, but it doesn't look like there are too many cancellations, so it has a lot of happy bride and grooms and families in the end. But we did get about 6 inches of rain. The winds were in the 30s to 40s for about three straight days, with gusts up around 60. Some damage did happen to the town pier. Some sailboats were sunk. But all in all, you know, it was a nor'easter that Nantucketers are used to. It just lasted a day or two longer than they usually do out here this time of year.
There was a shellfish closure, though. Was that related to the storm?
That was related to the storm, and it has happened in the past. It's not necessarily uncommon when you have a storm of this type with a lot of rain primarily. You have a lot of stormwater runoff into the harbor, and when you couple that with the half dozen to dozen or so boats that sank in Nantucket and Mattaquet harbors, state fisheries officials closed all of Nantucket waters to shell fishing. That's quahogs and oysters and clams and scallops. It's not scalloping season just yet, which is a good thing, but the ban was lifted on Wednesday morning, and family scalloping season, also called recreational scalloping season, opens on Sunday. So a lot of people were a little bit worried about that, not sure they'd be able to go out and get their first Nantucket Bay scallops of the season, but the ban has been lifted. They can go out with their push rakes and their snorkels and get bay scallops starting on Sunday, and that season extends right through till the end of March and commercial season, which most people pay attention to when the scallops start showing up in island fish markets. That starts November 1st.
Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Steve Junker. With me is Patrick Cassidy. Patrick, from the Cape Cod Times, an interesting story about a bill introduced on Beacon Hill that has the potential for local impact. This has to do with the siting of group homes. Will you explain this for us?
Yeah, and it seems to be prompted in particular by a move by an organization called Homeless Not Helpless. And that group was trying to put a group home into a neighborhood in Hyannis. Neighbors became upset. They said, listen, there's already several of these homes around, and we feel like we're being burdened by another one of these homes and whatever problems may come from that. The advocates for these homes say that these, you know, people are not an additional problem, and that actually they're being helped to better themselves and become productive members of society. That's the whole organization's mission. But in any case, the state representative, William Crocker, who represents that area, said he would file and did file this bill, which essentially looks for an exemption to a longstanding basically restriction on how much you can restrict something like this going into place. And it's based on kind of an educational component that some of these group homes have with them, that other organizations have with them, saying you can't really restrict that something that has that educational component from going into a particular area. It's known as the Dover Amendment. There's very few exceptions. I think we found two across the entire state to that. But in any case, he was looking to say, well, we should make this an exception, and we should allow the town of Barnstable to essentially restrict homes like this from going into these areas. There's a lot of questions and potential problems with the bill. The state senator for the Cape and Islands, Julian Sear, his office has said, we think this is a non-starter. We just don't think you can do this. There's a lot of pushback that occurs when you try and do anything that affects the Dover Amendment, and legislators in general are fairly protective of it. So it's in, you know, the process, but whether or not it gains any traction or has any viability is an open question. Obviously, the neighbors want to see something happen. Representative Crocker says this isn't about this past home. We're not going to kick them out at this point, but we want to look forward to, you know, trying to limit the amount of these types of organizations that come into an area like this. And again, the ramifications are potentially much broader, including potentially for something like Cape Cod Hospital. I mean, and other nonprofit organizations that may be putting facilities in that area.
Hmm. Ann Wood joins us from the Provincetown Banner now. Good morning, Ann.
Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. And in Wellfleet, there's a bit of a controversy over some people locating the coolers for their oysters when they take them off the grants. Tell us about this.
Well, I'm calling it the case of the Wellfleet cooler, because the case is basically the question is whether a cooler is a building or a piece of equipment. The cooler that we're referring to is on Berta Brunage's property. The cooler is 20 feet long, 8 feet wide, and 10 feet high. It's painted forest green and apparently sounds like an air conditioner when it's on.
20 feet long. Just tell us the dimensions one more time, because they went
20 feet long, yeah. 8 feet wide, and 10 feet high.
Okay.
So do you think that's a building or a piece of equipment?
I'm not weighing in here.
That's the question. So some people think that it's a building because of the size of it. And originally, Berta Brunage did get a building permit last year for the cooler. But the cooler permit was revoked by building inspector Brian Harrison in January because he decided that the cooler didn't qualify as an accessory to the home because it was purchased by the oysterman, Jason Wiseman, who works on a grant, not Berta Brunage. So Brunage actually bought the cooler from Wiseman for a dollar. Wiseman used to work on a grant, now has his own shellfish grant, and Berta Brunage has her shellfish grant. Now, these shellfish grants have oysters on them, and in the winter, oysters need to be pitted. Historically, they've been pitted in, like, old Title V holes in the ground so that they won't get ruined by ice
when you
in
say
the wintertime.
When you say pitted, just for people who don't know, that means taking the oysters off of the waterfront and putting them into the ground for the winter.
Right, because the oysters on grants, or aquaculture grants, are in cages. And if you leave them in the cages, if ice moves into Wellfleet Harbor, it can just sort of shred the cages and kill off a lot of the oysters. So Wellfleet fishermen forever have been pitting their oysters, taking them off the grant and putting them on pits, old Title V tanks, the old Title V sites and stuff like that, putting them in the ground. Recently, there's been some die-offs in pits, and because people are worried about disease during the summer with oysters, now they're putting them in coolers. So this is kind of a new thing. Anyway, Berta Brunage's neighbors hates the cooler. She says that it's huge and it's noisy and it's near her bedroom and she can see it, and it'll take 10 years for the trees to grow large enough to hide it. Her name is Dickerson, and she doesn't live there year-round. And so she brought in a bunch of people who live in the area also who don't live there year-round, except for one, who were complaining about this cooler, and they brought it to the Zoning Board of Appeals. And the Zoning Board of Appeals found that the cooler's fine. That was the end result. But, I mean, there was a huge, long process, and the neighbors have been trying to take it to land court and keep bringing the suit back because they just don't like a cooler being there. The locals are saying this is like a typical thing of new people moving in and thinking that seeing working shell fishermen in their front yard and their water view is ruining their view. The newcomers, though, are saying that they just don't want a gigantic cooler near their house.
Ann Wood of the Provincetown Banner. Ann, we're going to have to leave it there right now. Thank you for joining us.
Take care.
I'm Steve Junker. This is the News Roundup on The Point. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. We're going to go to the break right now. When we come back, we're going to hear from Teo Wolf of the Sandwich Enterprise. There's more in a moment. Welcome back to the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. And on the phone with us right now from the Sandwich Enterprise is Teo Wolf. Good morning, Teo.
Good morning.
Teo, you have a story about Town Neck Beach in Sandwich taking a hit from Storm Jose last week. Tell us what the impact was to the beach.
Well, it's hard to say exactly how much sand they lost. I was just talking to the director of natural resources yesterday, and he said that he didn't think it was quite as bad as the last winter storm that hit, which was Stella, at which point they lost 5 to 10% of the sand. But the tropical storm Jose did carve a huge cliff into the newly refurbished dune there, and now there's a big 10-foot drop off from the top of the dune to the beach, and they've closed a lot of it to the public because it's pretty dangerous.
Now, this section of beach has a history of taking a beating. What are they looking at for a fix, and is it a, sort of a wider fix that's going to be in place for a while?
Yes, they are looking at their environmental consultants, which is a called Woods Hole Group, has told the town that they need about 400,000 cubic yards of sand to bring the beach back to health. And the town is working with the state and the Army Corps of Engineers to develop a plan for periodic sand replenishment from dredging the Cape Cod Canal and borrowing some sand from Scusset Beach, which is also part of Sandwich. And they're looking also at dredging the harbor there. It wouldn't add a lot of sand, but it would add a little bit. And they're saying that even if they had that 400,000 cubic yards, they would need to replenish it every year every other year with, you know, something like 50,000 cubic yards of sand. It's an ongoing, as you can see, problem.
And so right now, what are they looking at just immediately then?
Just immediately, they're going to have to regrade the sand. They had to do this after the winter storms last year too. They have to in 2016 they put in about 120,000 cubic yards of sand at a cost of $3 million, and these storms have just sort of started whittling that away. So they each time these cliffs are carved into the side of the dune, they have to regrade it and make it, you know, safe for people to traverse.
Teo Wolf of the Sandwich Enterprise, thank you for joining this morning and updating us on the state of Town Neck Beach and Sandwich.
My pleasure.
I'm Steve Junker. Joining me is Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. And Patrick, another story we've been following the last few weeks is a proposal in Falmouth to alter the town's beach rules. It's taken another turn this week. Bring us up to date.
Yes, it has. And this is a petitioned article that would be on the November 6th town meeting for Falmouth. It was seeking to impose these fairly restrictive regulations, highly restrictive as far as some people are concerned, necessary as far as other people are concerned because of problems at area beaches. These are beach rules. They were brought forward by Howard Grosser, who is the president of the Falmouth Heights Mira Vista Neighborhood Association. He said he heard from his members that they were having problems at area beaches. There was too much noise. There was tents that were going up. There were things that were happening on these beaches that they didn't think were safe. And so he brought forward these rules. After he got his petitioned article essentially on the town meeting warrant, Selectmen came up with an article that they were proposing that essentially said, we're going to look at this beach rule thing with our beach committee and we'll go forward with that. Grosser got a lot of pushback from folks, specifically Phil Alfonso, who runs a local Facebook page and is very outspoken. And they were basically calling him the fun police, and people were cracking down on things that could happen on the beaches. But some of the things, I guess, I already thought weren't probably allowed, like lawn dart tossing, which I thought that game was actually made illegal, and personal jetpacks, which I don't have mine yet, but apparently that's a thing. But in any case, they were saying that these rules would really restrict the amount of fun that you could have on the beach. And Grosser went to Selectman recently at this week's meeting and said, hey, listen, if I had known about your article, I would never have even brought mine forward. As long as we're looking to address this issue, I'm fine. You should vote to essentially ask the town meeting vote to indefinitely postpone my article and move forward with yours to have kind of a more broader, more robust discussion about beach rules and how they should be changed, if at all.
So it's more about the process we're and how this process goes forward. The rules themselves have yet to be identified.
Yeah, no. Again, he had identified certain rules that he wanted in place. You know, you can't have any radio that could be heard 15 feet away from the source, that sort of thing. But again, the process now is going to be the selectmen working with the beach committee and kind of crafting or reviewing existing rules and figuring out if they work.
George Brennan joins us now from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve, and good morning, Patrick.
Speaking of the fun police.
And here he is. George, some people might consider eelgrass a kind of seaweed and wonder how it could really be very important. Your reporter Barry Stringfellow has a nice article looking at eelgrass and what it means to the island and about a project to restore it. Tell us about this.
Right. Well, it is so important to many species of fish and shellfish, including bay scallops, which depend on eelgrass for oxygen. And it's been dying off at an alarming rate in many of the ponds over here on Martha's Vineyard, including Lagoon Pond. And what's really concerning is one of the healthier ponds, the Nempshire Pond, has had a 17% decline in recent years. And that's caught the eye of the Division of Marine Fisheries. And through a grant, there's a program to try a new technique planting eelgrass. The die-off, you know, is systemic from nitrogen, and dragging has also been an issue in past years. Measures have been taken to control that, and nitrogen loading, and also, you know, there is no dragging allowed anymore in any of these ponds. When the scallop season opens in the next few weeks, shell fishermen will only be able to dip net and not allowed to drag. So there are measures in place to prevent the die-off, and now they're looking for ways to restore it.
And tell us a little about the project to restore it that's underway now.
Yeah, so this is happening, as I said, through the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. A grant was given, and this is happening over in the area of Lobsterville Beach, and it's just they use these metal girds with the eel shoots attached, and they're hoping that this will foster them to grow and multiply.
George, looking at another story you guys have this week, the fishing derby is still underway. It's a great tradition, 5 weeks at the end of the summer. You have a new take on it this week. Tell us about this.
That's right. So our fishing columnist, Barry Stringfellow, is on a staycation. He's gone fishing. He's out there trying to catch his derby fish. And while he was out, we went searching for someone to write a guest column, and that was Adam Darick. And Adam wrote this great column about a Sunday afternoon spent on the water with his daughter, Baylin, who is just the ultimate fishing enthusiast. She just loves to go out with her dad. And there's a great photo of her with her catch. I mean, if you take a look at the picture online, I hope people will, she caught almost a 15-pound bluefish. It's almost the size of her.
Yeah, it looks like it's going to tip her over the way she's holding it, yes.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, she proudly carried it in to have it weighed. This is a big deal on the vineyard. Kids all want to catch a fish that they can bring and have measured and weighed. If you can make it onto that leaderboard at the weigh station, that's just like the ultimate for any vineyard kid and adult. And not sure yet. We haven't heard from Barry whether he's caught anything worthy of being weighed, but I'm sure he'll be weighing in next week.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Steve, and take care, Patrick. Hope you're catching something out there.
not a big bluefish like that, but...
I saw a picture Patrick brought in.
He's
doing
all right. Take care, George.
Patrick Cassidy, the Cape and Islands have, as yet, we still have no medical marijuana dispensary, but gradually it does appear to be moving closer. You've got a story that kind of updates that.
Yeah, and moving closer in terms of it's actually being grown at a Plymouth facility, the marijuana that would be brought to a Mashpee dispensary to be sold here eventually. Again, there's no dispensary open here on the Cape, but they are kind of in process. The Mashpee dispensary is pretty close to being completed. They need to get a certificate so that they can open officially. They're saying by year's end. And this is an operation that's being run by Medical Marijuana of Massachusetts. They were kind of one of the first in the game. They ran into some headwinds right away. There were some questions about whether or not they were given, I think, favorable treatment in the beginning. But they fought it, and they came through a legal process and were able to move forward. And they're this organization that's going to have, again, this large 46,000 square foot growing facility in Plymouth, or facility that I think it includes the growing facility and a dispensary there in Plymouth. And then the product that's grown there and then processed there will be brought and delivered to Mashpee, to this Echo Road dispensary in Mashpee. And that's where it'll be sold in the form of, you know, Joe caps and sublingual sprays, salves, oils, creams, obviously marijuana buds, joints, etc. But then, interesting enough, and our reporter Christine Legere and our photographer Steve Heslip visited the facility in Plymouth and talked to the folks who are organizing this whole thing. Everything that's brought to Mashpee every day, whatever's left over, will be brought back to Plymouth and stored there in Plymouth in this, you know, more secure facility. And again, they say the Mashpee dispensary is secure itself, but they want to make sure certainly that they're accounting for everything and that it's all in one place. And they have all these protocol in place. They have cameras that are going to be all over the place watching everything that's going on. So, for instance, at the Plymouth facility, they can have somebody watching the Mashpee facility at all times as well, even if nobody's there at the moment. So they're taking a lot of precautions. Obviously, it's a new industry. This is the medical marijuana side of it. The recreational marijuana dispensaries are still also much further down the line, although Medical Marijuana of Massachusetts, interestingly, says, you know, we have room for expansion. We may end up wanting to get into the recreational side of things. The law as written, you know, there's some questions about how that occurs when you're a medical marijuana facility. Can you become a recreational marijuana facility? Can you make your dispensary into a recreational facility? And it's not exactly clear. There's still a lot being sussed out, even with the rewriting of the law that recently took place on the recreational side. So obviously, a lot of folks are paying attention to this. Dispensary in particular seems like it's well along, and again, they're hoping to open up by the end of the year. They say they may be open just by appointment at first, but it's a step in the process that's been kind of long running from now. I think it was, 2012
long,
or something, that
process.
Medical marijuana was legalized. So we'll see how long it takes for recreational marijuana to get a dispensary anywhere on the Cape, but this looks like it's happening here as far as medical goes.
Before we wrap up, I want to talk about this story about a fellow from Provincetown, or I guess he spent a lot of time in Provincetown, who died this week. You've got a nice profile of him, Julian Popko, who really brightened the town in a lot of ways.
And anybody who was there around Thanksgiving would know Mr. Popko as the guy who put together the lobster pot Christmas tree, which they would light up around Thanksgiving, and it would stay lit through the February time frame. Again, he was an artist. He was somebody who his family says was a great family man, and he was somebody who had other sculptures and things that were scattered around town there in Provincetown. He was well known. He loved lobster fishing. He was really in tight with lobster men, and that was part of the idea with the lobster pot tree, was to kind of recognize lobster fishermen. He died on Sunday at the age of 78. His family's remembering. Obviously, the community is remembering him. He first came here with his wife in, I believe, 1964, and they decided to buy a cottage in Truro, and they kept coming back, and they really became part of the fabric of the community. So this is one of those figures that a lot of people knew and certainly loved and looked forward to his various sculptures. Some folks will know about Bubbles the Whale out on McMillan Wharf there. Mm-hmm. He found that and restored it and then donated it. So there's pieces of Julian Popko really throughout town in terms of people remembering him and seeing, you know, these physical manifestations of his work and his love for the community.
And one final note here. Last week, a story mentioned some boaters who freed a leatherback turtle they found entangled. We heard from a pair of scientists who point out that it's always best for boaters who encounter any entangled sea animal to immediately contact the U.S. Coast Guard or the Center for Coastal Studies, who can ensure the safe disentanglement and that no gear is left behind to cause more damage later. Center for Coastal Studies has a hotline at 800-900-3622. If you hear a story that you'd like to comment on, you can reach me by email. I'm Steve Junker, Steve_Junker at capeandislands.org. You can go to the website capeandislands.org, find contact information there. That's our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you, Steve.
And thanks to all our other contributors. Thank you for listening. I'm Steve Junker.
The Friday News Roundup is produced by Steve Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.